The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they're
easy, but because they are hard.
Start by 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginton. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginton.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have one of our favorite all-time guests with us tonight, Dr. Zubrin, so I'm going to cut to the chase and skip most of the front-end work and the announcements, and I'm going to treat the program as a short one and just call out our sponsors so that we can maximize our talk time with Bob. But our phone number, for those of you who would like to call us, is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. And email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Do check our website newsletter. It's posted on our website in the upper right-hand corner, and it shows everything for this week, plus all of the programming through the first quarter and the start of second quarter of 2020. A couple of other things to point out are that all of our shows are archived, and you can easily listen right off of our website or quickly download them. If you need help with any of that, click on Listen Live in the upper left corner. Then I also want to remind everybody that we are listener-supported and a 501c3 nonprofit. So because many of you do support us, we're able to do these shows. We're in our 19th year now, and thanks to many of you and your support, we can bring you these programs with Bob and many other high-quality guests and many new and very innovative people that maybe most of us haven't heard of before. So we appreciate your support. Remember, if you're a taxpayer, you get a tax-free deduction, on your IRS, your federal taxes. The same is true here in California. All of that information is on our website, along with a big PayPal button up at the top of our homepage. And we do appreciate your support. And then do remember, we have website and Space Show sponsors. You see their banner ads going across the homepage, which you can change as often as you like. And our sponsors include Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Integrated Space Plan. And as I said a few minutes ago, Dr. Robert Zubrin is our guest tonight, and we're very happy to have him back. And all of you should know who Bob is. He is a very well-known and highly regarded author. He is the founder of the Mars Society. He is always in the press and in the media and in interviews advocating for Mars. And he can tell us why again tonight. We can never get enough of it because, in my opinion, our country, our nation, and I think our world really needs it. So you can check out Bob. You can read his full bio. It is on our website. I want to maximize our time talking with Bob. Welcome back to the show. How are you again, Bob?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me.
Always a pleasure. So the news was a couple of days ago that you went down to Texas to Boca Chica, and you had a great meeting with Mr. Musk. So can you start out and tell us about that?
Yeah, it was an extremely interesting meeting, and also a tour that followed the meeting of the Boca Chica site and saw what was going on there. Let me just start out by explaining the plan as Elon laid it out to me, and then I'll give you my views of it.
Okay.
All right. So first of all, he's not building a ship. He's building a shipyard. Okay? As far as he's concerned, the primary issue here is not developing the Starship. but developing a production line for starships. Okay, that is, it's not a question of building one or three or ten. It's a question of building hundreds. That's how they're going to be made cheap. And in fact, what I saw there was they were simultaneously expanding the facility and creating facilities to build starships, and they were also building them already. They have something like 300 people employed there now. In a year, there'll be more like 3,000. And Elon's goal, as he put it, is to be able to turn these out at a rate of 2 a week. And that's how they'll be made cheap. Now, you know, and then the mission architecture he has described is to fly the starship to Earth orbit, refuel it with a number of tanker starships. You probably need about 5 or 6 to refuel it to go to Mars, and then it would land on Mars and eventually be refueled to come back. Now, he recognizes that a problem with Starship is because it is so massive, it takes a great deal of facilities to be able to refuel it. And so he anticipates that the first several, perhaps 5 starships that land on Mars will stay on Mars. In other words, that the beginning of the mission architecture is to deliver a massive amount of cargo, equipment, the robots to set it all up, before you send the first one out with crew. When I, pointed out that depending upon the mass, it might take between 6 and 10 football fields of solar panels to refuel a starship within the 500-day stay on Mars, he said, fine, that's what we'll do. That is, whether it's 600 kilowatts, 100 kilowatts on Mars, average day-night power, is about a football field. And if you're doing it with solar, and he wants to do it with solar, he's not going to have nuclear power. Whether it's 6 or 10, he felt it was doable. So the mission architecture is that it's not Apollo, it's D-Day, and then presumably the first crew will be large. It might not be 100, but it's not going to be 4 or 5. It might be 20 or 50 and create the facilities, greenhouses, all this kind of stuff, get it going, and then you could start sending much larger numbers of people. That's sort of the mission architecture right there. And now make some comments of my own. Elon frequently overpromises, but nevertheless delivers far more than anyone else in the end. So he might not deliver first, but he delivers the galaxy. And so 2 starships a week, that's a lot. Maybe there'll be 1 a week. In 1944, the United States was producing an escort aircraft carrier every week. Now, how did we do it? It wasn't that the thing went from start to finish in a week. It was that they had a large number of groups, and each one spent a few days on the carrier as it moved down the line. And so it might take a year or two for the individual carrier to be produced, but there were 50 of them in production at any one time, and so they were coming off the line at a rate of 1 a week. One could envision that sort of thing for the starships. Musk said he thought he could produce them for $5 million each. My own mental calculation of this is it's probably something more between $10 and $20 million. But even so, let's say it's $20 million, and let's say sends 100 people to Mars one way, and it stays on Mars to provide housing for them they expended hardware cost of sending people with their Starship apartment house to Mars is $200,000 per person. So, and if you get to Musk's numbers of cheaper than $20 million, then that number goes down. And so if we're talking about ticket prices to Mars of $300,000 to Mars, which is a number as being sort of the target range if you want to do immigration to Mars as opposed to exploration missions, you're in that range. So there's that. Now, one must say that if you compare this mission architecture to Mars Direct, which is, of course, the mission architecture that I was responsible for developing and which this is partially based on, the biggest difference is the size of the ship. It's about an order of magnitude bigger. That's why it takes an order of magnitude more power to send it back. It is optimized for colonization, and it is suboptimal for exploration because you have to send a large amount of facilities to a given location before you can go there with people. Mars Direct, we sent one Earth return vehicle to the site that we were going to go to, and then we would send the crew there. Here you have to send a number of heavy lift vehicles and set up a whole base before you can send a crew. So exploration is not what this is about. This is about building a major base and then commencing settlement. Now there's some other issues here. Musk, okay, he wants to, you know, I have discussed with him the idea of building a mini Starship and using, you know, staging off of that and going to Mars with that. There's an advantage of that, which is, first of all, it means the Starship, if it doesn't go all the way to Mars and back, you can reuse it. I said in 10 days. He said you can use it again the next day. He figures he can have a one-day turnaround. Well, the shorter the turnaround, the more disadvantage there is to sending the Starship all the way to Mars and back. But if you're producing very large numbers of Starships, the fact that some of them go to Mars one way and others are out of action for 3 years while they go to Mars and back is less important if you have a whole fleet of other ones to do whatever you want with. But as far as building a mini Starship is concerned, which would have a tremendous advantage for an exploration architecture because it wouldn't need a big base in order to refuel to come back, he was adverse to that. He feels that developing one thing is much better than developing two things. Now, I have a different feeling about that, especially in view of how rapidly SpaceX can develop things. Basically, he does not have the pathological fear of development that the aerospace majors have. He's quite willing to develop new things and develop it fast. But nevertheless, he felt that it would be better to do this all with one vehicle, the Starship. Of course, he needs tanker Starship as well, but he did not think of that as a major deviation from the basic Starship. There are some other issues here that he may have to confront. One is landing a big Starship on Mars is a major plume impingement problem. And by the way, it's much bigger problem on the moon, which is why I think the architecture that SpaceX has proposed of just landing Starships on the moon is probably not feasible. That would be a very strong reason to develop the mini Starship or just use the Starship as a fully reusable heavy lift launch vehicle and launch a conventional architecture off of it. Because I don't think you can land a Starship on the moon until there's a lunar base that has created, you know, strong landing pads that can take the plume of the Starship. On the Mars, it's a bit less of a problem, but it's still a major problem. And if that can't be resolved, he may be forced to go the mini Starship route. But at this point, he's going to see if he can make it work with just the basic Starship. There's also some other issues. For instance, the Starship, you know, has this stainless steel hull, and he can do reentry from Earth orbit with that because he has a very low ballistic coefficient, which reduces the heating load. So he can do this with a steel ship without, you know, shuttle tiles or anything of the sort. But coming back from Mars, there's a much higher heating load than there is just coming back from Leo. So he may have to make specialized starships that are reinforced thermal protection to do that, or else, once again, go with the mini starship or some other specialized vehicle. And as it's not necessarily the case that one size can fit all, but that is what he's going to try to make work first. If it doesn't, he'll adapt. And that's the other thing. Okay, the thing that is remarkable about this whole approach is this, and this is what would cause many people in aerospace to shake their heads, but he's building these things in production before he has even flown the first test vehicle. In other words, most people would build one and prove it before you send it into production. He's sending it into production before it's been proven. And his philosophy is he's going to launch the first one, and it may well fail, but he'll have five others on deck at that point, and the second one will be modified to remedy the cause of the failure of the first. And if that doesn't succeed, then he's got a third and a fourth. And by the time he gets to the fifth, there'll be five more waiting. So, you know, NASA built five space shuttles over 12 years. He'll be building these things at a rate of at least 10 a year to start, and, of course, with his objective of getting to 100 a year. Maybe he won't get to 100. Maybe he'll get to 50. But even so, one reason why those space shuttles cost billions each is because the entire workforce needed to build one needed to be kept around year after year in order to build a second. And also, of course, launch operations. SpaceX is already launching Falcons every 2 weeks, which is more than the rest of the American aerospace industry combined. It's about a quarter of all the launches in the world. And you know, they intend to take that model forward. Anyway, that's what's going on there. It's an incredible thing to see. But they're already producing the parts for, you know, several starships, and they've created a facility which they are expanding with the idea of before the first starship flies, there probably will be at least, you know, 1,000 people there, maybe 3,000, and they'll be already turning them out at least at a rate of one a month and probably faster. That's what's going on. Now, they might very well do a starship flight to high altitude. 20 kilometers is the objective of the first starship flight, other than hover tests. And they might even do 100-kilometer flights. But I didn't see evidence of the Super Heavy in production, and that's going to have to be produced before it reaches orbit. So I do not think, you know, they saying they want, you know, of course, last October, Musk said he'd have Starship reaching orbit in 6 months, which would be this April. That's not going to happen. It's conceivable we might see suborbital flights of Starships by the fall, but I think we're going to have to wait at least until, you know, the 2021 before Starship makes it to orbit. That's still incredibly fast. I mean, it's wildly fast by current NASA standards, where they've now been working on SLS for over 30 years and hasn't flown. But even by Apollo standards, Saturn V was 5 years from program start to first flight. That was pretty good, but I think Musk will beat that with Starship.
I have a couple of email questions for you. Todd is in San Diego, and he said, Bob, did you see or discuss anything about habitat and life support, either what's going to happen on the way out and the way back or on the surface of Mars?
No, I didn't see anything of that sort. I know that they are looking at life support systems elsewhere. But I think the main thing at this point, the first objective is going to be getting Starship flying as a fully reusable Earth-to-orbit system. So in other words, to have a vehicle with Saturn V-like capacity, but one-tenth of the launch cost or less, because it's be fully reusable. That is the first objective here. I do have to say, I don't think that they are yet devoting much thought, certainly not enough thought, to Mars surface systems, ISRU systems. Musk tends to focus on one or a few things at a time, and right now his focus is on, first and foremost, creating the production facilities for the Starship, and secondly, perfecting the Starship itself, and which he views as two parts of the same problem, because in order to perfect the Starship, he's going to want to have lots of them to throw at the problem. The landing of the Falcon 9 failed the first five times. Okay. And so now, of course, there was no loss in that because everyone else always lost their first stages without even trying to save them. But nevertheless, it took six tries before they successfully landed the Falcon 9 first stage. Now they know a lot more about these things now. Of course, when they launched Falcon Heavy, two of the boosters were successfully landed and the center one was not. On the very first launch. So they, have reason to be optimistic that it won't take that many flight tests before they get it right. But nevertheless, at this point, they're prepared to take losses until they do get it right.
Listener Helen is in Seattle. And she said, is he concerned, does he express any concern about potential regulatory roadblocks along the way, including planetary protection?
Yes, he is concerned. And he strongly urged me to continue the argument that I have made in the press and elsewhere against these crazy planetary protection people that would basically stop us from sending humans to Mars and are even impairing the robotic exploration program. He saw this as something very important that I and other space advocates could do on their behalf. This fight needs to be won if they're going to succeed.
Is he doing anything to fight it too, or is he just calling on advocates and interested parties to help out?
I don't know what he's doing himself. He didn't discuss that, but he he liked very much the several recent articles I've written on this subject, refuting these crazy planetary protection people, including this recent article in Quillette, where someone actually claimed that the danger was we would bring back microbes from Mars that would consume the water in the Earth's oceans.
Yeah, that's the one we talked about with Batchelor a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, Musk saw that article and he saw my reputation as well. He feels this is something very important that they're building the ships, but we've got to help clear the way. We can't be spectators here.
Well, so this gives me another question. I was going to bring it up later, but we're at it now. So this was posted on my blog for you. It's by somebody named Mark. It's very short. I'll read the whole thing, but I don't think Mark is alone out there. What makes Dr. Zubrin so confident that there is no possibility of a dangerous organism on Mars? Astrobiologists like Gil Levin, and by the way, Mark, he's not an astrobiologist, of Viking missions say the possibility for harm to humans of Earth's biosphere cannot be excluded. Don't you believe in the possibility of Martian organisms mutating into harmful forms with unknown side effects on terrestrial life? Thank you.
No, it's not possible because we get rocks coming here all the time from Mars, and careful examination of them, in particular the Allen Hills meteorite, which as a result of the controversy it provoked, was subject to more detailed examination than probably any other rock in history, showed that large portions of it had never been raised above 40 degrees centigrade during its entire career of ejection from Mars, flight through space, and reentry and landing on Earth. And this has been, we get 500 kilograms of this stuff landing on Earth now, and as you go back further in time, the rate was much higher because the rate of meteoric impact in the early solar system was much higher than now. Most of the debris has already crashed, and the rates are lower now. They were faster in the past. So we've gotten billions of tons of Martian materials have been delivered to Earth, and so if we could get the Red Death from Mars, we already have. Okay. So this entire subject is absurd. What it's like these people who want NASA to go through heroic measures to quarantine or even pre-sterilize the Mars sample brought back from the sample return, which would be a crime against science, because if there is life on Mars, there might be life on Mars. It's quite impossible. But it's nothing that hasn't had a chance to come here many, many times already. The idea of quarantining rocks from Mars is like having the Border Patrol stop cars crossing the border coming in from Canada to check to make sure no one's bringing in Canada geese. Okay, because the geese are coming in all the time in large numbers through the air. And by comparison, the numbers that tourists might bring in their cars, assuming that there are anyone who's doing that, is insignificant. This is simply not a possibility. And as far as, by the way, water-consuming microbes, we already have water-consuming life on Earth. It's called plants, okay? And we have water-consuming microbes. They're called algae. And they've been on Earth for 3 billion years, and they have not destroyed our water supply. They have created a cycle that makes use of water, turns it into other things like organic material and oxygen, which are then used by animals and recycled back. So this is just hysteria. I mean, if you want to be afraid of microbes, the people you really got to watch out for are gardeners, because every time you turn up a piece of soil, you're bringing back to the Earth's surface material from the past. And we know there were diseases on Earth in the past. Dig down a foot and you're bringing back sediments from 1919 when there was a flu epidemic that killed 50 million people. Dig a few feet and you're bringing back sediments from the era of the Black Death. Okay? And in other places, of course, you can dig in and reach the Mesozoic. And there's every reason to believe that there were diseases of the animal kingdom in the Mesozoic. And yet we don't quarantine archaeologists or paleontologists or gardeners. They are bringing back materials from eras in which there were certainly macrofauna and macroflora, which there are not on Mars, and in which there were unquestionably diseases.
What is the effort to counter some of the draconian effects of planetary protection? Is it just speaking out like yourself? Is there an organized, formalized kind of resistance effort?
Well, no, it's a debate. It's a war of ideas. It's one we have to win. Now, there's another thing. There's another issue that has come up, which is that, so you have the scaremongers who are talking about back contamination, and then you have the astrobiologists, or some of them, who are saying you don't want to send people to Mars because you could contaminate Mars with microbes from Earth, and then you would never know if the microbes that you found on Mars were native or brought by you. Okay?
Okay.
Now there's two possibilities of microbes on Mars. One is that they are different from Earth microbes, in which case you unquestionably know that they're native. The other is that they're the same. Well, they're the same. They could be brought by you or they could be native. How would you know the difference? It's simple. If they're native, it means they were there in the past, in which case they would have left residues, biomarkers, fossils, all this stuff. And this would unquestionably prove that they were there in the past, just as finding fossils on Earth proves that there was life on Earth in the past. The only people who don't believe that fossils prove the existence of past life on Earth are creationists. Okay? And similarly, if you don't believe that fossils and biomarkers found on Mars would prove that life was there before you got there, then you are that person is no better than a creationist in his denial of science.
You have a phone call on hold. Let me let you talk to whoever this is. Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program with Dr. Zubrin. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Doug from Redlands, California.
Hi, Doug. Go for it.
Okay. Bob, just want to ask you back on that question of the Starship landing on the moon. Do you think a first Starship to do that could be sort of low payload and use just a few engines and therefore not have so much exhaust?
I don't think it will work because even the Starship with zero payload is still something that weighs 100 tons. It's going to have a gigantic plume, and it would blow a crater. And in fact, it would, because there's no air on the moon. If there was a base on the moon, this material, it would actually have unlimited range, because the exhaust velocity of a Starship is greater than escape velocity from the moon. You could actually not only blow material all over the moon, you could blow it up into orbit. In fact, one positive side effect of this is that you could blow debris into space and destroy the lunar orbit toll booth.
So what I'm saying is, if the very first one were to land, there wouldn't be any base for it to sandblast. And if that first one that landed released telerobots that started constructing...
But it wouldn't land, you don't understand. It would dig a crater and it would fall over. In other words, in order to land a Starship on the moon, someone has to go there first and build a landing pad. So that it's not blowing debris all over the place and digging itself a crater to fall into. So that's not a good architecture. It just isn't. And aside from the fact that there's no way to refuel the Starship on the moon. And now, you could send two Starships to the moon, and the first one has a payload of methane, and then you make liquid oxygen on the moon, and you use the methane that you brought together with the liquid oxygen that you make. And it's a very awkward thing. I mean, look, fundamentally, Starship is designed, first of all, yes, it is a fully reusable heavy lift booster. And in that capacity, it could do everything that SLS is supposed to do, but at a tiny, tiny fraction of the cost, less than 10%, just lifting heavy payloads to orbit and then staging off the Starship and doing lunar missions in any number of more conventional ways, okay, such as you could do the Apollo architecture, you could do the Moon Direct architecture that I laid out. You do anything, it would all be enabled by Starship, just simply acting as a reusable heavy lift booster. But landing the Starship on the moon is a bad idea. And aside from acting as a heavy lift booster that could enable, well, any kind of space activity in that way, and also it could do point-to-point, surface-to-surface transportation on Earth. That's another very positive potential application of the Starship. And I discuss this a lot in my book, The Case for Space, because I think there's a much bigger market, surface-to-surface travel on Earth, than there is in space launch, at least for a long time into the future. And that could be why you would want 1,000 starships. The other thing it's for is for the colonization of Mars. And it can deliver large payloads to Mars. It could deliver, Starship landed on Mars, you delivered an apartment house to Mars, along with a big cargo. Yes.
Did you speak with Elon or SpaceX about this issue of whether the Starship can land on the moon? And if so, what did they say?
I didn't speak to Elon. I did speak to another engineer there about this, and he said they're looking at it.
Okay, because they run simulations, and they have artwork for what it's worth. I mean, it's sort of raising expectations of Starship landing on the moon.
Look, there are certain things that can happen and certain things that can't happen. You know, in Elon's initial presentation of, the Interplanetary Transportation System at Guadalajara in 2016, he showed a Starship landing on Callisto, okay? But some of this stuff is fanciful. Some of it can work. Surface-to-surface transportation, Starship is great because the two-stage system, the first stage returns to the initial base, the other one, you leave Los Angeles, the Super Heavy lands on the offshore spaceport near Los Angeles, the Starship goes and lands in Sydney, and then off the shore of Sydney there's another platform and they've got Super Heavies there and they can throw you back. And methane oxygen as a propellant choice has a number of virtues. One, okay, the reason why I chose it for Mars Direct and why Elon has chosen it for Starship, if it's decisive, is it's the easiest propellant to make on Mars. Another is simply that it's a very good propellant combination. It's got the second highest specific impulse of any realistic chemical propellant and a much higher density than hydrogen oxygen. But the third is that it's the cheapest propellant combination that there is. Okay, running on natural gas and liquid oxygen is the cheapest propellant. Now, if you have an expendable booster, it doesn't really matter whether your fuel costs $1 a gallon or $100 a gallon, okay, because the hardware you're throwing away dwarfs the propellant cost regardless. But if you have a reusable deep booster, propellant costs matter, especially if you're trying to produce get costs down to the range where you're competing with, first-class airplane prices. And this can do that. So that's another application. So these are three very good applications for Starship: surface-to-surface, reusable payload to LEO, and the colonization of Mars. But landing Starships on the moon, once there's a lunar base, you'll be able to land Starships on the moon. It'll be hard to refuel them to come back. And, what is the necessity for a ship that brings 100 people to the moon and, I guess, lunar tourism once you have a fully operational lunar base. But what NASA is trying to do on the moon right now is exploration and perhaps the initial development of a base. And for that, the Starship, in terms of as a landing vehicle, is not optimal. As the heavy lift vehicle supporting it all, it's very optimal. Okay, it's far better than anything they have. But it's a little big to use for a limb.
All right. Thank you for answering my question.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. Listeners, Doug has cleared the phone line, and you're welcome to call in and talk to Dr. Zubrin if you, too, would like it. It's 1-866-687-7223. Bob, we talked about the moon with that call with Doug, and people are a little bit confused as to what our moon plans are. Can you unconfuse? I know that's bad grammar, but can you clarify? It seems like the president's budget calls for us to go back to the moon, but the bipartisan House committee doesn't. What's happening, and is it important? And can Musk bypass all of this and just do his Mars thing?
Well, Musk is bypassing all of this and doing his Mars thing. Okay.
Okay.
So that's point one. So this is the real space program, and It's quite possible the first Starship will land on Mars before NASA accomplishes its moon landing. I would, not yet the first human mission, but the first Starship landing on Mars happening. Well, NASA's not going to be landing a person on the moon by 2024. So maybe, if they're doing it by 2028, which is probably more like theirs, I think Starships will be landing on Mars before NASA lands a person on the moon again. Because, while there are issues with his architecture, he's very determined, and he's prepared to make changes and do whatever it takes to make it work. Now, in terms of NASA's moon program, well, first of all, it was confused by the insertion of this deep space gateway, which was something thought of before there was a moon program. In fact, it was thought of as an alternative to a moon program during Charlie Bolden's time. It was an alternative to the asteroid redirect mission, which itself was thought of as just trying to create an excuse to send Orion capsules to somewhere beyond Leo. But since they couldn't get an asteroid to lunar orbit, and they thought it'd be a little silly to just go to lunar orbit and pretend there was an asteroid there, although they did discuss that for a while, they said, well, we'll build a space station there. And then supposedly this space station would eventually be a base for sending missions to Mars, which you could not come up with a stupider plan for sending humans to Mars. But then the Trump administration decided that they wanted to actually go somewhere for real, and they said, we're going to the moon. But then they had this lunar or this deep space gateway, which they called the Lunar Orbit Gateway, and I don't know what they're calling it now, but forcing the lunar mission to use this station only makes the lunar mission harder, okay? It's really just like the thing that wrecked the first President Bush's space exploration initiative. At that point, NASA was trying to sell the space station, what we now call the International Space Station. I think at that time it was called Space Station Freedom. And so it was a requirement that lunar missions be assembled at the space station. And so they came up with a much more complex lunar mission plan than Apollo, which dismayed, I mean, in 1989, there were plenty of people in NASA who had done Apollo. It was only 20 years before. And, they looked at this crazy plan and to build a gigantic space station with hangars and orbital construction shacks and cryogenic fuel depots and repair shops. And they said, if we could put a man on the moon, why can't we put a man on the moon? And putting this lunar orbit gateway in on the critical path to landing on the moon only makes the mission much harder. There's a lot to not like about SLS, but if SLS had a proper upper stage and if they use a Dragon as a capsule instead of the overweight Orion, or simply scaled the Orion down, you could do an Apollo-type architecture with those things. But instead, the whole thing's very confused. Now, this year, they are finally actually asking for money for a lunar lander, okay? Because, one thing, you do want to land on the moon, you need to be able to land on the moon. You don't need a lunar orbit gateway. You do need a landing vehicle of some kind. And now they're asking for the money. And they might get it, or they might not. Because, they're asking for this big plus up in NASA's budget at the same time they're demanding cuts in a large variety of social programs. And I believe that in this polarized environment, the Democrats will say they're cutting the social programs and giving the money to the moon mission. Now, of course, they're not commensurable. They're only adding about $2 billion to NASA's budget, and they're cutting hundreds of billions elsewhere. So it's not like that money is really going to the moon mission. But the contrast between what they're increasing and what they're decreasing, and the fact that the House committee is not particularly supportive of this plan in any case, it throws it in some degree of doubt.
Since you mentioned the gateway, I'm going to mention another blog comment or question that came in for you today. It's actually long, and I've got a caller on hold, so I'm not going to read it all. But listeners, if you want to read it all, you can go read it all. But I'm going to read the first line or two. And the person who sent it uses a handle called Not Invented Here. And I have no idea what this person's real name is. He does blog fairly often. I wonder if Dr. Zubrin would consider toning down his criticism of Gateway and the three-stage lunar lander design. While Gateway and the three-stage lunar lander is not the most optimal way to reach the moon, they're the best solution if you want to maximize utilization of existing commercial launch capabilities. And then he goes on to defend the Gateway and some other things. So I guess he wants you to tone down your criticism of the Gateway, which obviously you haven't done in this program.
No, okay. And in particular, yeah, the three-stage lunar lander, this architecture that they put forth on this, with all these different flight elements, a three-stage lunar lander, and an ascent vehicle, of course, the various launch vehicles, the four different launches, there's five flight elements, there's actually six rendezvous in the mission. It is, the least capable lunar architecture I've ever seen. You know, by comparison, Apollo had three flight elements and, one rendezvous, and one launch. It was a far better architecture. Basically what this architecture with all these, you know, actually 15 different, critical things, literally 15, six rendezvous, five flight elements, four launchers, is in, it's like somebody writing the school play to make sure every kid gets a part. They are not spending money to do things. They are doing things in order to spend money and make sure everybody gets a piece of the action. It's really waste, fraud, and abuse. Okay, and furthermore, the whole thing is crazy because, you know, they say we're going to the moon because we now know there's water on the moon. Well, first of all, they're not going to the lunar pole, and they're not building a base, okay, either at the pole or elsewhere. They're building a base in lunar orbit where there is no water. And if you do this thing that, for instance, Lockheed Martin put forth this concept of having this thing go to the lunar pole, get water, and bring it back up to the gateway to electrolyze to make propellant to use to go down, it turns out they use 40 tons of propellant transported from Earth to go to the surface of the moon and bring 2 tons of water back to the gateway. It makes no sense at all. It's a completely crazy architecture. It must be criticized, and it's outrageous that people in the community who know better are not speaking up because they want to be team players. It reminds me of there's a great book called Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman. It's about World War II in Russia, and what he goes through in there is how tyrannies are maintained, both the Stalinist tyranny and the Nazi tyranny, because nobody is willing to speak up. Everyone is willing to live a lie, and that is how these things are sustained. And, you know, what can one say?
People
need to live in truth, especially engineers. Engineering is about truth.
Let's go to our phone call that's on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you and where are you? And thank you for calling.
Hey, this is Marshall in Little Old Renfro, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And all I can say is amen. quote, unquote. You got to make the people with the money happy. Oh, that's Congress. And how many engineers are there in Congress?
Social engineers?
No. I mean rocket science engineers, you know, math geeks.
I don't know. Maybe
Bob
knows.
Well, here's the thing. There's some blame to be placed in Congress, for sure. There's a couple of influential people insisting that, SLS be used, Ryan be used, and so forth. But actually, I have to say, Bridenstine has simply taken those requirements and superimposed on that an additional requirement that additional money be thrown around to a bunch of new players as well. And it's a mess.
Yeah. The reason I actually called was not to listen to the sermon and totally approve it, but does Elon have any use for the International Space Station, or is it basically something that really wasn't designed too well and hasn't adapted and should be scrapped?
Well, Elon is not using the space station. Other than the fact that the space station needs logistics requirements, and he's quite willing to supply it.
Mm-hmm.
And basically those requirements have funded development of Falcon 9 and Dragon. And the further development and maturing of the SpaceX team in the process. But the space station is not part of his mission architecture for going to Mars.
Okay, so the Starship really doesn't have any plans for going or even doing a pleasure cruise up to the International Space Station just so they can show that they can dock.
We didn't discuss it. It's not inconceivable that he might do that. I mean, in other words, if he can get the cost of Starships down, as he says, One potential application is actually space tourism. I mean, if you have a Starship with living quarters for 100 people, and if a Starship launch, say, can be gotten down to, say, $10 million, then that means $100,000 per person. You could take people to Earth orbit and
visit the station and do a tour.
They could visit the space station or not, or just, you know, frankly, the Starship is a bigger space station than the space station.
I have to agree with that, too.
Okay. But, yes, they could go to visit the space station if they wanted to. That would be... You know, they could have day cruises, week cruises, month cruises, whatever. There's also an issue with the Japanese artist of sending a group of people on a trip to around the moon and back, this sort of thing. So you could use Starships for this sort of thing for local tourism.
Yeah, well, I was thinking the International Space Station has to be boosted on a regular basis, and I was thinking it could also be set up to boost the International Space Station to where it really isn't going to, in the long term, come crashing down.
Well, yes, although the space station, so long as you're supplying it, they can use some of the used-up consumables as propellants to maintain its altitude. The space station's at an interesting altitude. If you go much higher, you get into the radiation belt. So they orbit in this sort of, 400-kilometer orbit where the radiation is modest and the reentry, the orbital decay time is relatively long. And so they can maintain that orbit and...
they don't really get too close to the Van Allen belts, except at the extremely high and the extremely low. The inclination's what, 51.5 degrees or something silly like that?
Right.
So they clip the north and south ends of the radiation belts, which causes a problem. But Anyway, I've already talked too long. Let's have somebody else have some fun.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you.
Listeners, Marshall has freed the line. If you'd like to call and talk to Bob, 1-866-687-7223. You have an email that came in while Marshall was calling from Stephanie, and she is in New York City. And she says, it seems to me that what Musk is doing is sticking it to the government and many people in our industry because he isn't playing by the rules that they advocate and they think are so important. One of those rules is that we need to have international participation on our moon missions and going to Mars and a lot of what we're doing. I don't see any room for international participation in what Musk is doing unless they might be an investor in SpaceX. Do you have any comments on international participation, SpaceX, and this maybe being an impediment for Musk down the road?
Well, there's actually plenty of international participation in SpaceX. Because, as you may know, the founder of SpaceX is an immigrant to the United States from another country.
South Africa.
And, you know, while I was at SpaceX talking with Musk, they had a mariachi band playing outside the building, and hundreds of people were lined up applying for jobs, and a large number of them were Mexican-Americans. An engineer that showed me around the place was a Canadian by birth. Actually, Canadian and Australian citizen who had immigrated to the United States. So the United States is a nation of immigrants, and so people of all countries are participating in this venture.
But not their governments, which is, I think, what Stephanie's talking about.
Whose fault is that? Now, I have to...
Well, she's just citing it as a possible impediment that Musk reminds all these people that their dream is not being met through what he's doing.
Well, it depends. I think there are people all over the world, I know in Russia, who are cheering for Musk, who, you know, want us to open up the space age. The age of humanity is a spacefaring species, and he's a hero around the world. And now there are some who would emulate him. I know there are people in China who are attempting to put together a Chinese SpaceX, and there are five such companies that have actually received significant investment. And you know, Musk has proven that entrepreneurial space is possible. That it can outperform the old guard by a lot. And there are plenty of people who are willing to step up. The entrepreneurial space race is opening the ability to participate in space to people of every country. You know, the other entrepreneurial company that has actually reached orbit is Rocket Lab, and that's a New Zealand company. And New Zealand doesn't even have a space program. You know, until there was Rocket Lab, if you were from New Zealand and wanted to participate in space activities, you needed to immigrate to the United States, but perhaps to Europe. But now, New Zealand has a space program, not brought to you by the New Zealand government, but by the creativity of New Zealand people. And so, you can... you know, immigrate to the U.S. and join the SpaceX team, as many of his people have, or you can start your own in any country, whether it has a space program or not.
You have another caller waiting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
The question I have about your talk about landing the Starship on the moon is the issue that that the moon dust itself is going to be blown up by this landing.
That's exactly the issue. And the amount of dust that you blow up, the size of the crater you create is a very strong function. It's like the cube of the thrust of the lander. And so what was very doable for the Apollo LEM is just an extremely formidable problem for a Starship.
Okay, well, question I have is, okay, do we have good measurements of the depth of the dust? I mean, how deep it goes?
Well, you hit rock, don't you? I guess the answer to that is no. I don't know exactly how deep the Apollo astronauts dug, but it certainly wasn't, 10 feet. So, no, we don't have good measurements of that. So there's somewhat of an open question there. But the people that have looked at this seriously, regardless, is a very serious problem. Look, Starship can help support the Lunar Initiative tremendously as a reusable heavy lift vehicle. It would enable, the Moon Direct architecture that I've advocated. It's a very powerful lunar architecture, very cost-effective. It could, of course, enable an Apollo-type architecture, except with Starship replacing the Saturn V, making the whole thing much more cost-effective. There's any number of things it could do. But using a Starship as a LEM is just, it's like using a battleship for white water rafting. It's just not the right vehicle for that application.
One of the things anybody suggested is that once it's flying, it would be the only vehicle that perhaps could actually do it until this NASA mission that you're talking about actually gets ironed out or whatever happens with it. And I'm beginning to see your point that that's going to become cumbersome and politically difficult.
Yeah. You could use it as a reusable heavy lift vehicle. If you develop the tanker system, which Musk is going to develop, you could fly the thing all the way to translunar injection or even into lunar orbit and then deliver a lander to such a position. I prefer just to fly it to Earth orbit and then use a reusable hydrogen-oxygen vehicle to go from there to the surface of the Moon where it could refuel and go back to Earth orbit. And then you have a fully reusable lunar architecture. I've described that in my Moon Direct architecture, and in those articles I had it supported by a Falcon Heavy, but in this Starships would make it, you could do it on a larger scale. But it's just the wrong the Starship is a reusable Saturn V. It is not a LEM.
I agree with that. I'm just always wondering if I suggest this is hypothetically we might have it available and we wouldn't have a LEM available at that time.
Well, yeah. But
what about this idea? What if we brought the thing down to a hover and didn't try to actually land and do a measurement of how big a crater it would make and then just go up after that and not try to land on the first mission and then make some observations as to what happened or something?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just think, someone, whether it's Musk or, if Blue Origin ever actually gets active, they could develop a lunar lander. Why does everyone expect Musk to develop every piece of space hardware that someone might want? If someone wants to land on the Moon, they should develop a lunar lander.
Give that job to Bezos. I kind of like that idea in the sense that the idea of commercial space trying to copy what everybody else is doing and competing against the same thing rather than taking out their own specialization and excel in that one area. That's a good idea, I think. Maybe Bezos should take that on.
Yeah, if he wants to go to the Moon, he should develop a lander. Now, you talk about a lander, but I don't think, in other words, Musk is approaching the problem of getting humans to Mars as if he really wants to do it, okay? And that's fundamental here, okay? NASA is not approaching the problem of sending people to the Moon with the same urgency that Apollo had, let alone the urgency that Musk had. if you want to do it, you really got to commit yourself, and that means not doing things that are tangential. I mean, you know, one thing, you know, and as I'm discussing with Musk about, you know, I'm talking about a mini starship and how it could be used, which, by the way, in my view, is something that feeds directly on the critical path, and clearly, I'm sure Musk wouldn't agree, wouldn't be useful. Nevertheless, he thought he could do Mars without it. The NASA is taking an approach to the moon of, yeah, we want to go to the moon, but before we do that, we're going to build a lunar orbit space station, and we will dream up architectures that make use of it, even though it's obvious that you can get to the moon without it, because they did it before without it. And so you want to take the attitude of, you know, I want to go directly, and if you want me to develop anything beyond what I'm developing now, prove to me that I need it. As opposed to, I want to develop as many things as I can, and I can dream up excuses for doing all sorts of things before I do what I'm supposedly trying to do.
Do we think, what about this issue of landing on the Mars? This won't be a problem like it would be on the moon, I guess?
Well, it's not as big a problem. I mean, for one thing, Mars has an atmosphere, so you don't get microscopic, you know, dust particles would very quickly come to a halt if they're blown around on Mars. Whereas on the moon, they can fly all the way to Earth. It's less of a problem on Mars. It could be a problem, but it's probably less of a problem. It is less of a problem. And
I'll close with this thing. I had quite a little smirk when you mentioned the idea that Musk might get to Mars before the NASA program succeeds in landing on the moon. I had to laugh at that idea. But it could happen, I guess.
It could easily happen. It could easily happen that not necessarily people landing on Mars, although that is even possible, but I would actually think that a starship, an unmanned starship, will land on Mars before NASA lands a person on the moon.
Hmm. Wow. Well, I'll get off the line and see if anybody else wants to call and talk to you.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Listeners, John has freed up our line. If you want to call, there still is time, 1-866-687-7223. And Bill is in Tucson with another email, and he says, Bob, earlier in the program, when you were giving an impression of what was going on at Boca and the Musk project, you mentioned that the price might get down for tourism with Musk at about $300,000 per ticket. This is going to Mars, as I understood it. That's around the going price of suborbital tourism. Would this destroy the suborbital industry?
Well, I don't know if there is a suborbital industry. I'm skeptical of the suborbital industry because how many people are going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars for a few minutes of zero gravity? I think if there's going to be space tourism, it has to at least go to orbit. Look, last year, 2018, there were about 100 satellite launches in the world. Musk got like 24 of them. It's a quarter of the whole world, which is to say about half of the launches in the free world, where you conceivably could compete for them. And that was just with Falcons. He has cut the cost of space launch by a factor of 5. Starship will cut it by at least another factor of 3. This is what people are going to have to compete with. And so people who want to be in this business are going to have to get serious at this point. When Musk first came along with the Falcon 1s, people could laugh it off, say, isn't that cute? And when he developed the Falcon 9, they said, okay, he's one of us now, but we can do pretty much the same thing. But then the Falcon 9s become reusable and the costs start coming down, and all of a sudden he's taking all the launches. And, there will be launch companies in other countries that have protected markets from SpaceX, like China and Russia. And there may be some for small launchers that are launching CubeSats and stuff like Rocket Lab. But people launching sizable payloads are either going to have to get with the program or get out of the program.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim. Go for it.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Elon Musk was planning on using maybe nuclear power for his Mars endeavors, maybe kilopower. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, I certainly heard of kilopower. The issue is this. The government needs to develop space nuclear power. Okay, it really does need to be the government, because the materials involved are very protected. Okay, and so if NASA did produce a space nuclear reactor, and I think it would be interesting to him. Now, to refuel a Starship, you need at least 600 kilowatts, if not a megawatt, depending upon how their weights ultimately turn out to be. And kilopower is like a 10-kilowatt unit. Now, a 10-kilowatt unit is of some interest for a Mars base, because it gives you a reliable amount of power for life support in the case of a dust storm, turns all your solar panels off. ISRU doesn't need, reliable power in the sense that you know you have power today and not just tomorrow. Life support, you must have the power all the time, period. ISRU can, so long as the average power is enough to get the job done, it can proceed in stops and starts. So a kilopower reactor as a backup life support system for a basis of some interest. But I really think NASA should step up to the plate and not – kilopower is very good, by the way. I'm not putting it down. It's great that they're finally doing something real in the space nuclear power arena. But they need to go beyond it. They need to start making at least 100-kilowatt units. Okay, 100-kilowatt units, you could have 6 or 10 of them, and you could refuel a Starship. If you had one of them, you could do Mars Direct. But that's the kind of, and I think that, the reason why we have government scientific agencies is to develop things that the private sector can't do. And space nuclear power is one of those things. And so I think that this is a very good thing for NASA to be doing.
Tim, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. I was just kind of taking everything in. What about thorium? Would the regulations be more lax on maybe a thorium reactor?
Well, thorium is very good for commercial reactors on Earth, and it could also use it on Mars. There's thorium on Mars. Thorium you breed into uranium-233. Space nuclear reactors, you want them to be light for the amount of power, and so you use highly enriched fuel, which is why it's so carefully controlled, because the kind of material they use in space nuclear reactors is basically bomb grade. And that's why this is something that NASA should do. This is something that the government needs to do. This is why we pay our tax dollars. We don't expect Musk to create a Marine Corps for the United States. That's a job for the U.S. government. Well, space nuclear power is also a job for the U.S. government.
Tim?
Well, that's it. I'm done.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
Listeners, if you want to talk to Bob, he's still available, and we still have time left. It is 1-866-687-7223. How do you think space and all of what we're talking about will fare after we have our elections? Do you think presidential politics are going to interfere with any of this in our plans, or we're just going to go on and continue to develop as usual, especially on the private side?
Well, the private side, I believe, will continue. Okay, that's one of the great things about this entrepreneurial space revolution, is that, Musk is going to keep at this regardless of whether Trump is elected or Klobuchar is elected. Bernie Sanders could be a problem, but in the main, NASA has always had this problem, being constantly being jerked around every time this change in administration. All the medium and long-term plans go out the window. And it's made it very difficult to accomplish things. One of the reasons why Apollo was successful is you had basically between Kennedy and Johnson, a two-term administration got the whole job done, which, by the way, is why if the government is to do it, they cannot do it on a 30-year schedule, because that guarantees there will be change of administrations that will wreck the program. It needs to be done on, 8 to 10 years or less. Okay, and that was also part of the logic behind Mars Direct. You want to get to Mars in 10 years or less. You can't do it in 30 years. So the private initiatives will continue, especially Musk, who is willing to proceed. I mean, he's going to Mars, whether the government's going there or not. Okay, but the moon program could easily be tossed in the trash if the Democrats win the election. Then they'll come out with a different program. Unless that program is put on a quick timeline, it will probably end up in the trash before it is carried out.
You just wonder what one can really do to assure these things continue, especially when the government program is kind of a crappy program to begin with. So
it is a problem. I mean, look, the asteroid retrieval mission was absolutely doomed as soon as Trump was elected because it had no rational basis. It was only being supported because this is what we're saying we want to do. Be a team player and support whatever we're doing. The Trump moon program is crazy in the way it's being done. And so if the Democrats win, it will be very easy for them to shut it down because they say, well, look, this is stupid, right? So we're shutting it down. Now, the problem is that there's every likelihood that whatever they put in will be just as stupid. There is a Mars program associated with the Lunar Orbit Gateway, which involves building a deep space transport, a giant electric propulsion system that will travel back and forth between the Lunar Gateway and a Mars Gateway and never land on Mars, which is totally stupid. I think that is the program that was supported by this House committee. So they were opposing one crazy program with another crazy program. But if you have a program which has got a strong rational basis, it can get public support and it can get enduring political support that is bipartisan. And I think a Humans to Mars program based intelligently conceived could be that. I still think... Call me old-fashioned, my father, all my uncles served in World War II. They set the world straight. And when I was growing up, we sent people to the moon. And, we believed that the American people, through its government, could accomplish great things. Okay?
Right.
And it's been a very distressful experience to watch the increased senility of the NASA human spaceflight program. You know, Saturn V was developed in 5 years. Shuttle was developed in 10. SLS, I was on the team that did the preliminary design of what is now called SLS in 1988. It's been 32 years, and it hasn't flown. And SLS is just the shuttle stack without the orbiter. The whole orbiter, including the launch stack and the orbiter, the whole shuttle, was developed in 10 years. And here it is. So this has been distressing. But nevertheless, I retain this belief that under the right circumstances, this thing can be put together again and we can have a can-do space agency again. I mean, the robotic space program is can-do, but the human spaceflight program is not. And the, you know, if SpaceX is flying starships to Earth orbit by 2023, 2024, and I believe they certainly will be, that there will be operational starships delivering payloads to low Earth orbit before the next presidential election, then whoever is elected in 2024 will be looking at that and saying, gee, look at this. Could we have people on Mars by the end of my second term? And the answer is going to be yes. They say, well, what's needed? Well, they'll say, well, Musk already has these starships and the tankers and stuff. You need to contribute the space nuclear reactors and a variety of other systems. NASA still has considerable expertise in life support systems that is not apparent that SpaceX has yet. You know, ISRU technology, you know, meet them halfway. Let's do this as a public-private partnership. We'll be on Mars by 2030. And you can take a bow as the one who made it happen. And I think, you know, Musk is going to make it sellable. And so I think that he won't have to ultimately develop it all. I think the American government, once they finally see that this is doable, will step up and make a contribution.
You have another email question. It may be the last one of the evening. Joe is in Las Vegas, and he says, Bob, there are a couple of other Mars programs or options that you haven't given us your thoughts about. Lockheed has a program called Mars Base Camp. I think it still is viable. Are you familiar with it, your thoughts? And also, many suggest rather than going to Mars that we set up and work on one of the Martian moons, mostly Deimos. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do not have a high opinion of either the Lockheed Base Camp or the Deimos plan, which is related to it. The purpose of going to Mars is to go to Mars. The surface of Mars is where the science is, and it's where the resources are, okay? I mean, Lockheed put forth this plan of this vehicle that would leave their so-called base camp in Mars orbit, fly down to the Martian surface, acquire water, bring it back to orbit, and make propellant to use to fly back down. Well, guess what? It takes more propellant to deliver that water to Mars orbit than the amount of propellant the water uses. It's the same thing as their problem with their lunar orbit toll booth plan. And it's frankly ridiculous. It makes no sense. If you're going to Mars, you go to Mars. You don't go to Mars orbit. You're going to make propellant not in Mars orbit. You're going to make it on the Martian surface. And you could use that minimally to go to orbit, but better yet, to go direct back to Earth, as I made clear with the Mars Direct plan and as Musk is going to implement.
What about Deimos?
Same thing.
So they say it's cheaper and easier and safer for the astronauts to be at Deimos. Any reply
to
that?
Yeah, it's cheaper and easier for the astronauts to stay home. But if you want to go to Mars, go to Mars. In other words, the purpose of interplanetary flight is not to set an altitude record for the Aviation Almanac. Okay, it is not. In other words, we travel into space not to fly around in space. It's to go to the worlds on the other side of space. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And so we don't, you know, do missions to lunar orbit in order to you know, look out the window at the moon. If you want to go to the moon, go to the moon. And if you want to go to Mars, you go to Mars. And anything else is just silly.
You have a caller on hold, but I was going to bring up, and I'll just mention it, but it's probably too late in the show now, your Atlantis article. But you have a whole section in that about purposeful space flights, which is what
right.
or purposeful programs, which you're talking about now.
Yes, it's the difference between a purpose-driven space program and a vendor-driven space program. A purpose-driven space program has a goal, and it spends money to do things to accomplish that goal. A vendor-driven program does things in order to spend money to please the vendors. The Moon program is being conducted as a vendor-driven program. That's why it has 4 launches per mission, a gateway, you know, 5 flight elements, and 6 rendezvous. It's designed that way in order to spend the maximum amount of money and the maximum number of parties to give everybody a piece of the action. Musk's program is purpose-driven. He's trying to get to Mars with as few flight elements as he possibly can. Now, he may be pushing that beyond the limit. He may need an additional flight element, which I have advocated to him, and he does not yet accept, which is a mini Starship. But basically, his attitude is, show me why I need it, okay, which is the right attitude to have, okay, as opposed to, I want to do it, show me why
I shouldn't make, do it.
Yeah, show me why I should.
you have another caller, and this will probably be our final call for the evening. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
Hi, it's Tony Cook calling from Griffith Observatory.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good.
I was wondering if you had heard the news that today that Gerstenmayer, who used to be the head of NASA's human space program, or space flight, I guess, program.
Yeah, he went over to SpaceX.
Yeah, it was just hired by SpaceX. I didn't know if that had been discussed at all.
No, it hadn't been discussed.
Not, if there's any, no, if, and I hadn't heard that, and that was not discussed with Musk, so that's news to me. So they're getting someone in there who has a very large amount of human spaceflight experience. So that will strengthen them. I think, though, that the culture will remain that defined by Musk, which is go like hell.
And then, the only other thing is I was wondering if, Dr. Zubrin, if you think that Artemis is salvageable at all. Assume it's given some kind of reprieve, which doesn't seem likely, but if it were, could elements of it be turned into a successful program that would help develop resources that could be used for going to
Mars? I suppose so, but it has to change radically. You know, in other words, if you're going to the moon, you need to go to the moon, not to lunar orbit. You need to be focused on building a lunar base. You need to be focused on making use of lunar resources and having a mission architecture that is designed to use them. So you want to have, I mean, minimally, ascent vehicles that use liquid oxygen as the oxidizer, and potentially hydrogen-oxygen vehicles that use both hydrogen and oxygen derived from lunar water. Now, look, if Starship is flying and they have a fully reusable heavy lift vehicle, that could make Artemis a much more doable proposition. Now, of course, at that point, you know, there'll be Senator Shelby, if he's still in office, saying, no, I want you to use SLS. The whole point of the Artemis program is to use SLS.
Right.
And and so there'll be some conflict there. I think the Starship program is going to succeed, but it hasn't succeeded yet, and who knows what could happen. Perhaps it could fail. You know, there could be a hurricane and the Boca Chica could be destroyed, or Musk might get himself into trouble with his Twitter account and and things can happen, okay? And if Starship fails, SLS will get a lease on life, although I have to say SLS, when we designed it, we had an upper stage with 250,000 pounds of thrust. It was a J-2. They put a weak upper stage on SLS, which cuts its capacity in half. It doesn't, even on its own terms, SLS is not currently being implemented correctly. But if they correct that, and there are certainly people around who are making that point, although I think the Trump budget proposal, they avoided funding the upgraded upper stage for the SLS.
Right. When Vice President Pence talked to people at Huntsville early on, I guess it was around during the summertime, he kind of said, you know, if SLS isn't ready on time, we're not committed. We don't feel committed to use it. You know, it's like there's other things being developed. We'll go to that if it's not, if that's what's going to hold us up. You know?
But I
haven't seen anything to kind of back up that they're really thinking of using anything else. But
no, they're not, because, I mean, the Gateway itself, and before it, the asteroid retrieval mission, were thought of as things to do with SLS and Orion. Just as the space station, frankly, was thought of as a place to fly the shuttle up and down to. Heavy lift vehicle is a very useful thing. Now, SLS should have been flying by 1994 because, as I said, it was just the shuttle stack, and they've certainly made a meal of this. And so it's arriving 25 years later than it should, and by the time it flies, it's going to be faced with competition that make it obsolescent, or obsolete, actually. And that said, if it had been flying in the mid-90s, it would have had a nice quarter-century career of enabling a variety of great missions and be ready for honorable retirement. Instead, it's showing up at work just in time to be fired. After spending God knows how much money, I think it's a lot. There it is.
Okay. Well, I guess I look at like China's approach, like with the Chang'e mission, which are eventually supposed to get to the point of being able to demonstrate like 3D building using lunar materials and carrying little life support, you know, units and, actually building stuff out of lunar material to verify that a base actually could be built, in the 2030s. That seems like a more rational approach than just, willy-nilly buying all kinds of lunar landers and things. I don't know.
Well, I think you're going to, if you want to establish a lunar base, you're going to need a lunar lander. You're going to need to land some HAB modules on the moon and a lot of different kinds of equipment. Because before you start 3D printing things on the moon, you're going to have to make iron on the moon by reducing lunar soil, but it requires power, it requires certain kinds of technology. You're going to have to deliver that stuff.
Right. But they are actually looking at what materials are there now. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
There's one more thing I'd like to talk about.
Okay, I've got a quick email for you. You can put this away real quick. Can I give you that first?
Sure.
Tim from Huntsville, who you just talked to, wrote in and said, if geneticists can track your ancestry back tens of thousands of years, they can tell whether Earth-based microbes got to Mars and whether they hitched a ride with astronauts or debris from the KT asteroid that struck the Earth millions of years ago, let alone the difference between Martian life and Earth life.
Well, that's true. In fact, if you remember back in 2001, there was this, what's it called, anthrax.
Right.
Scare. Right. And so anthrax was being delivered to people and by a terrorist of some kind. And the, well, first of all, they could identify that the microbe was anthrax. It wasn't some generic unknown microbe. Okay.
Right.
They could identify what it was. But not only that, they could see that it actually came from a lab in Ames, Iowa, and that it differed from the current strain there, and the amount of genetic drift was such that it had been taken from there 15 years before. That is, you could actually tell that this sample that these were descended from were taken from Ames in 1986. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So if you find microbes on Mars, if you know, if they're identical to E. coli found in Florida right now, you can, you know, good reason to believe you brought it. But if they've had a lot of genetic drift, maybe they came from the KT impact. Or maybe they came 3 billion years ago. Or maybe we came from there 3 billion years ago. But if they're native, once again, there will be residues. Life leaves stuff behind. You know, every kind of life leaves footprints. It leaves shells. It leaves cell walls. It leaves deposits of metabolic waste. It leaves fossils. And if they were there before us, that stuff will be there.
Okay. What is that that you wanted to bring up before I mentioned TMZ?
Well, the Mars Society just announced today, and you should know Elon was very supportive of this, a contest, international engineering design contest, to design a 1 million-person Mars colony. There's a $10,000 first prize, $5,000 second prize, $2,500 third prize, $1,000 fourth prize, $500 fifth prize. Last year, as you may know, we had a similar contest to design a 1,000-person Mars colony. We had 100 teams from around the world. Contest was eventually won by MIT. A Polish team came in second. So now this time it's going to be a 1 million person city state. Okay. There'll be 30 points for the technical merit of the design, 30 points for the economic concept of how it can be sustained, 20 points for the social and political aspects of it, and 20 points for the aesthetics, the architecture. And it's open to people of all nations. It's university teams are welcome, but it's not just university teams. You don't have to be at a university. You can be a single individual. You can be a club, a group of friends. You could be a network of people. Anyway, we just announced it today. It's posted on our website, the concept and the rules.
I'll link to it in the summary and on the blog to make sure people see it.
Right. And by the way, we just published last week the book of containing the designs of the 10 finalists and most of the semifinalists of the Mars Colony Contest of last year. It's available on Amazon, both in paperback and Kindle. The Kindle version is a lot cheaper. It's just $8, and it's in color. But if you like paper books, you can get it there as well. I think the paper book is also a bit cheaper at barnesandnoble.com. So if you actually want the paperback, that might be the best place to go. But the Kindle version is available on Amazon.
What is the name of the
Name of the book is Mars Colonies. And it's edited by Frank Crossman, a Mars Society member. It has an introduction by me. So it's called Mars Colonies. It's on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay. Well, we'll point everybody to it. Any other concluding comments? Anything you'd like to leave us with?
No. It's just one last thing is that looks like the Mars Society is going to be in Los Angeles again this year, quite probably at the University of Southern California and probably in October, but the arrangements, final arrangements, have yet to be made. We hope to announce that within a couple of weeks.
Okay, great. Let me know when that is done so I can put it out there, too.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate it very much, and look forward to the next time we get a chance to talk with you on the Space Show.
Same here.
Okay.
Bye.
Listeners, Bob is off the line, and we thank those of you who called and emailed. And, of course, we absolutely thank Bob. And we have Hotel Mars tomorrow. So Bill Harwood is talking to us from CBS News about America resuming human spaceflight. That'll be a different take from what we had tonight. And then we have our Friday program in the morning, and we have our Sunday program, all of which is posted on our website newsletter, our blog, etc. Remember, we're a listener-supported show. We thank all of you for listening tonight and for supporting us. Your feedback is always welcome. DrSpace@thespaceshow.com. Good night from Bob, who has already left the stage. And good night from David. Good night from the Space Show. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Keep looking up and keep it safe.